Good evening and welcome to this evening's book launch, which we hope to still be continuing despite the fact that we've lost 50% of the authorship of the book. Welcome to tonight's book launch. Of course, you're here to hear a presentation about the book, The Last Bluff, How Greece Came Face to Face with Financial Catastrophe and the Secret Plan for its Euro Exit. I'm delighted that we have both Victoria Tendrinou and Eleni Vavitsioti to present the book, and then delighted also that Hugo Young, I'm afraid,
died a while ago. But he may come and help us when we're in real trouble.
Hugo Dixon. You wouldn't imagine that I'm reading from the screen in front of me. Hugo Dixon will be making comments in response to the presentation as well. Of course, by way of introduction, you're here because we're looking at a case of tremendous drama, one of the biggest crises in the history of the European Union, a near existential crisis for European integration. And as I'm sure you've already picked up from the press reviews of the book, it is a book of revelations, of personality clashes, of institutional failings, of conflicting worldviews, etc. So this is a drama of much intensity, but also one of wider systemic relevance in terms of the European Union and, in particular, the Eurozone. So let me say one or two points by way of introduction. You'll see, I think, on the screen behind me, there's a Twitter hashtag, LSE Greece. Please join us in making your Twitter comments. We'd appreciate knowing your comments. And the announcement that you really would like to listen to is the fact that after we finish here, there is a wine reception. Before you become too optimistic, let me remind you that this is an LSE wine reception. But nevertheless, it is free and open to everyone. Let me tell you how to get there. You will go out of this building, back to Houghton Street, to the old building, the main building of the LSE, and go to the fifth floor and the senior common room. But if you follow, we will be like tourist guides, and you can follow me to the correct location. You're here because of the significance of the book, and I should have also mentioned one or two things by way of biographical introduction. Victoria Tendrinou is a reporter for Bloomberg News in Brussels. She's worked previously for the Wall Street Journal. She has degrees from the University of Oxford and University College London. Eleni Vavitsioti is the Brussels correspondent for the Greek daily newspaper Kathimerini and also Sky TV, a post that she's held since 2014. In 2016, she was awarded the Botzis Foundation Prize, Greece's most prestigious journalism prize, for her work on the financial crisis. And Hugo Dixon is a journalist, entrepreneur, campaigner. He is chair of InFacts and deputy chair of the People's Vote campaign here in the UK. Who knows, with our discussion, we might possibly make links between the Greek case and Brexit here in the UK. Hugo has written op-eds regularly for The Guardian, The Times, The Independent, Financial Times, Politico, and other publications. We're delighted to have each of them. By way of format, I'm going to invite two authors to say something by way of introduction about the book, and then I'm going to pass to Hugo to make comments. I'll finish by making comments. We'll have a brief discussion, but we will open it up to all of you for Q&A. and we will finish by about 7:50, 10 minutes to 8. So I think you're going to speak from here. Can you please welcome our panelists?
Hi everyone. Thank you all for being here. It's a lot of people. It's very nice to see everyone here. It's a bit of a different crowd that we were used to so far, so it's a bit more academic, a bit more serious maybe, so we're going to try to sound super sophisticated and smart. In all seriousness, it's really great to be here because I think obviously this book is about the Greek crisis or part of it, but we really think that at its core, this is also a story about the EU, EU failures, and how the EU decides and negotiates during crisis. So we think this is a great kind of environment to discuss something like that in. I'm aware that the audience is probably very Greek heavy, but for a couple of foreigners, at least that I'm aware of in here, I'm going to start with a bit of an introduction of the crisis and where we were at the beginning of this kind of era that we cover, and I'm going to talk a bit about what the book is about and why we did it, and then Eleni is going to go into the more important stuff of what we actually found out during our research. So this book is about the first half, essentially about the first half of 2015, which was a quite brief but super intense period in both Greek and European and Euro area history. For those of you who may not recall, within less than a year, Greece had two elections. It brought a radical left-wing government to power. It held a surprise referendum. It almost exited the euro. It defaulted to the IMF, being kind of the first developed country to do so. So a lot was going on, and it was very intense. So obviously the crisis did not start then. 2015 and the events of that year were long in the making, and they kind of marked the culmination of years and years of economic and political crisis the country had already been through. So just for some background and some context, Greece was mainly thrown into the sovereign debt crisis in 2009. That's partly because the global financial crisis that was happening exposed its weaknesses, its structural weaknesses, its state weaknesses, its over-indebtedness. The country had over at least a decade since it joined the euro, but more broadly accumulated a twin deficits, which is pretty poisonous, and it had a very high debt. So when the crisis hit Europe, Greece was the eurozone's weakest link, which meant it was soon cut off from international markets and someone had to help. The problem was that Europe was very unprepared to help it. There was really no system to grant loans to a country within the euro area like that. It was actually prohibited by the treaties there was a no bailout clause for these countries. But in any way, faced with all these issues and the sovereign debt crisis spreading to other countries, the eurozone kind of worked it out and granted Greece the first bailout in 2010. That was obviously very ill-designed and insufficient, as was proven quite shortly afterwards, and the country got a second one in 2012. And long story short, for months and years, the successive Greek governments actually were engaged in fairly acrimonious, very difficult negotiations with its creditors, made up of the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission representing Europe, over very painful reforms that the state had to undertake in exchange for just the next slice of loans to stay afloat. So the issue of the bailout, it kind of took over everything. It took over all the policy making. It took over the public discourse, the political discourse. I think it's a lot like what's happening here with Brexit right now in the UK. It kind of dominated Greek reality for 10 years. And of course, it's like a natural result. There was a lot of civil unrest. There was a lot of inflammatory political rhetoric. And by 2014, so 4 years in, the bailout kind of era, while some economic indicators pointed to some improvement, citizens were really not feeling it. There was a lot of disenchantment. There was a lot of sense that things were not getting any better. And there was a lot of mistrust towards the political establishment. So that's almost where we come in, where our story starts. So by that time, Syriza, which was a fringe party until 2009, it was gaining a lot of popularity on the back of this anti-bailout rhetoric, which a lot of other parties also used quite a lot. So Alexis Tsipras, its leader at the time, well, still leader, but prime minister since then, he would say that the creditors' demands were so rigid and so austere that the country was basically had ceded sovereignty to Berlin, for example. So there was a lot of people from Syriza and from the opposition in general saying that these programs should just be rescinded, the bailout should be torn apart, and some people suggesting that Greece could even blackmail its partners by threatening to leave the euro and take down everyone kind of to the abyss with them. So that's where a book roughly starts. So in January 2015, Greek voters elected Syriza to power. And a lot of people, at least in Europe, which is what we were covering at the time, didn't really know what to expect, didn't know the extent to which the government was going to stick to its pre-electoral pledges, how religiously they were going to follow that. But it became quite clear very soon that they were going to go for a confrontation with Europe. They weren't going to go for a quiet compromise. There was one big problem. Greece had no money, and it needed to pay both creditors, but also salaries and pensions that were falling due very quickly. And no one really knew how much money there was, and every month we would hear officials saying, they're probably going to default next week, we're not sure. We may have some more cash until, I don't know, the week after. But it was very unclear for how long this could go on. And that's how hundreds of hours of endless and often pointless negotiations started between the Greek government, which needed new loans, and the creditors, which were basically asking it to agree to the bailout that it was elected to abolish in order to get these. So as you can imagine, it was a disaster. There wasn't a deal coming anytime soon. And as for us, we were basically there. We were Greek journalists in Brussels working for Greek and international media. We kind of lived it all. And on the one hand, we were kind of the best placed people to cover this because we could understand the Greek sensitivities better, but we could also see the point of view of the Europeans a bit more. So maybe we could get the nuances that other people maybe couldn't as easily. But on the other hand, it was very difficult on a personal level because we weren't just covering this like amazing story. It was our country, it was our families back home. It was potentially our future at stake. So that's why we felt that this was something we should write about. I mean, the events of that period, they were covered very extensively by the press at the time, by media around the world, probably more so than any other EU crisis we've followed since and before that. But we felt something was missing, and that's largely because I think of the noise of the media coverage at the time. You can let a lot of stuff fall through the cracks. So we decided that we wanted to say the story, taking a step back, looking at it in a kind of more sober, more distant way, and putting together all the pieces of the puzzle that required looking beyond Brussels, which is what we were looking at, and seeing what was happening in Athens, in Washington, in Berlin, in Frankfurt, and all the different power centers. So basically, our aim was threefold. The first part is what we said, we wanted to explain, but also to understand ourselves what exactly was happening beyond the meetings, beyond the kind of Euro groups. For those of you who don't know, that's Eurozone finance ministers' meetings. I don't know the audience's acquaintance with Brussels terminology. So beyond these Eurogroups, beyond these summits, we wanted to know what was happening in the kind of the backroom deals, the private conversations between all the key protagonists. And we wanted to basically kind of explain, the second thing we wanted to do was to explain to each side, if that makes sense. So we wanted to explain to the Greeks kind of why the Europeans were acting the way they're acting, how what was happening in Greece had repercussions in other countries in the Eurozone, how it wasn't just contained to Athens and to the rest of Greece. It had effects everywhere in the continent. But also we wanted to explain to the Europeans and to the international audience more broadly kind of why the Greeks acted the way they did, that it wasn't just this crazy rational electorate, that there was a lot of reasoning behind a lot of the things that were going on. It wasn't a black and white story. It was much more complicated and much more nuanced, and we wanted to get this to come across. And the third reason is what I mentioned earlier, that we really thought that while this time period was short, it was only 7 months, it was a great snapshot of how the EU decides in times of crisis and in these kinds of intense negotiations. And we thought, you know, what better way to kind of examine it and demonstrate it than to do this project, which if we had known how much work it was, we wouldn't have done. But anyway, we did. And finally, from a storytelling point of view, I mean, it was amazing. You couldn't make it up, even if you were a screenwriter. You had colorful characters. You had a lot of people with vanities, intrigue, twists, and turns. And what's amazing is that a lot of our readers who were, you know, a lot of people in Greece and Brussels, who obviously knew what happened, they would say that they would wake up, they would stay up all night to like find out what's happening next, and they couldn't put it down, which is amazing because, I mean, it's not fiction, it's what happened. So that was, it goes to show how the story was very exciting. But anyway, just in terms of how we did it, we wanted to have this sober and kind of distant and holistic approach, so we started from scratch, and we created this very detailed timeline going from the first day to the last day of this period that we examined. And we kind of put in there all the reporting of our colleagues, and we wanted to kind of see what was happening every day in all the different places that mattered. So Brussels, Frankfurt, Berlin, Paris, possibly Washington, Athens, and we wanted to find what gaps we had, and then we set off to report this. So we started speaking to people first to fill the gaps, And then depending on what they told us, we would have more gaps. And then we would have to speak to them again and have more gaps. So it was a bit of a vicious cycle there. But, you know, it kind of worked out. And we started speaking to everyone involved, or at least everyone who would speak to us. So from people, again, in like Athens, Brussels, in Europe, across the pond, but we would also across the Atlantic. But we also different layers of you know, jobs, from prime ministers to technocrats, diplomats, even kind of the clerks of the European Council building where the summits take place. I go in and out of the meetings to serve tea and coffee to leaders and occasionally some alcohol. And, you know, they would get a sense of the room much better than a lot of other people. So we spoke to everyone we could. We traveled across the world. What we realized was that, is what I said, we interviewed 95 people for hundreds of hours. And what we realized was that the more we asked, the more there was to find out. So we hope we have at least found out enough to do this book, but there's still a lot to be investigated and examined about this time. So one thing that we realized quite quickly was that human memory and human testimonies, they're kind of like a living organism. We would speak to the same person the day after the events, a month later, a year later, and they would give us different versions of the story. And that's not because anyone wanted to lie to us, it's just because I think people create this narrative in their minds to explain what's happened in the past that kind of fits with what's come since then. And it kind of surprised us, and it made us understand that we needed more than human testimonies, than people's testimonies to write this. So we set out to find everything we could in terms of hard evidence that withstands the test of time. So emails, texts, private documents, personal notes, any confidential material we could find. And we would just go back to people again and again and ask for more and ask for more kind of like hard data so we could cross-check everything we write up and everything we had from the testimonies. Because our aim was basically to reconstruct all the crucial events that happened, all the key moments, and be like a fly on the wall for the readers. We didn't expect the book to be commercially successful. It has been. It's a very pleasant surprise. We're not complaining. But, you know, in the dark hours when we were writing it, we would kind of look at each other and count the people we thought would read it. And that didn't really exceed 20 people, including friends and family. Maybe a bit more. She has a big family. A lot of people kept asking, you know, why are you doing these? Are events of the past. They've really been covered in the press. But we really didn't care. We thought there was more to it, and we wanted to write something that could be used potentially as a point of reference in the future when someone looked at this period. So we hope we've like partly achieved in that. And its reception, at least so far in Greece, shows that there was a demand for something like this to be told, which has made us very happy. And on a personal note, it was also, you know, it was a very intense period for us, both personally and professionally, living through all this. So it kind of helped in a psychotherapy level, which was also quite nice. We got some closure. But anyway, enough for me on what we did and how we did it. Now Eleni's going to tell you a bit more about what we found out from it.
So many, many people ask us, how did you decide to write this book? And the day we decided to write it was super clear for both of us. We didn't even need to discuss it amongst us. We just decided it. And it was June 27, 2015. Maybe many of you might remember that day. The previous night, the Greek government had announced this surprise referendum. Maybe many of you were out in the lines and queuing at the ATMs, worried that the banks are going to be shut and you're not going to have access to your money. European officials, I can tell you, were very shocked also. They couldn't expect such turn of events. And the following morning, there was a Eurogroup, the finance ministers' meeting. And it was one of the dozens we had followed the past months. And there, for the first time, the meeting was split in two parts. It was the first part was with Yanis Varoufakis, the finance minister at the time, but then the meeting stopped and the finance ministers decided to continue without his presence because they wanted to discuss how they're going to firewall, how they would protect their economies in case of a Grexit, because it was obvious at this moment that we were heading towards that direction. And to us, but to most officials we spoke to, that day was a day that Greece found itself its closest to the point of no return, and, you know, it would be an exit from the euro with unpredictable consequences. So, as you can imagine, that day, the atmosphere in the council building was super heavy. We were in constant calls with our editors, Victoria in New York with the Wall Street Journal, and me in Athens with Kathimerini, and they were expecting our stories that day. And because we were also emotionally charged, and I think it was also the sleepless nights that we had the past days and months, we were like, okay, let's go outside, take a deep breath, and go back and write the story immediately. So we walked outside. It was the air was suffocating. We'll never forget how it was. It was gray and it was sticky, and it was this Brussels summer humidity, which I guess you have here as well. And it has just started drizzling. And at the entrance, overlooking the Berlaymont building, which is the headquarters of the European Commission, there was this official who was he stood there, and he was long involved in the Greek negotiations. He was holding a half-smoked cigarette on one hand, and he had a paper cup of a freshly drained espresso on the other hand. And he had been working on Greece since 2012. So he had seen also, if you remember 2012 again, Greece was on the brink of exit. So he had worked closely with the Greek officials and the Europeans to put back the country back on track. And he had worked and he had seen that things were kind of improving. But when snap elections were called in 2015 and Syriza came to power, he understood that things could get out of control. And he had placed a bet with himself saying that I'm not going to shave until the Greeks get the first bailout tranche. As you can imagine, that afternoon in July, he had like a Santa Claus beard. And so he sees us, he's kind of emotional, his eyes are red out of fatigue and emotions, and he's like, in the Eurogroup right now, they're discussing, guys, how to shield the Eurogroup without you, and I cannot listen to this discussion. I mean, I can't stand being in this room. I can't believe how fast we got, you know, after everything we've done for your country. So that afternoon, after that discussion, okay, we had to write the story. You can imagine it didn't really help going outside the building to get the fresh air. But we said that, you know, we have to write how things got so wrong so fast and what had gone wrong. So what we found out, we're going to briefly tell you, it's our takeaways. So number one, EU is much more political than we thought. If the same had happened in the US, which is a federal government, you would just delete the debt and just start from scratch. But instead now, in the case of the Eurozone, you had not one or two governments, but actually 19 governments deciding with different interests, agendas, priorities. So our recession, as long as the one was taking place in Greece, should have been treated with fiscal stimulus. But and after Greece had fixed its deficit, then the European partner should wipe its debt. And this did not happen in the EU. Things don't work that way. The Greek issue was dealt completely politically and not with under economic terms as it should have. Because you had different countries with different interests. You had one bloc, which were the southern countries mostly, the ones that have been through a bailout program, which the government at the time thought they were, you know, the ones that could understand us more, who were actually the harshest critics. They were saying that if we show any leniency towards Greece, that would make us look weak towards our voters. That will show that we did not try hard enough. The other bloc were poorer countries like the Baltic nations, Slovakia, Latvia, Slovenia, who would have to lend Greece to sustain or even increase the salaries as the government was asking at that time, while they had, in some cases, Greece had as high as double of salaries as what they had back in their country. So that was also out of the question. And of course, you had the bloc of the Calvinist countries, which are the German, Dutch, and Finch, which are the harsh ones. And they view the world as rule-based. And Greece, in their eyes, had committed a sin and had to pay. So don't forget also that in German, the word debt is translated to Schuld. Schuld, I don't know if it's how my pronunciation is, which is guilt. So you, in order to get into debt, it means that you did something bad, you haven't followed the rules, so, and you're asking Germans to forgive you, so forget about it. And on top of that, you had political agendas. I mean, who can forget that the first rescue program back in 2010, when Greece was literally at the brink of default, it was not given and was delayed because there were local German elections taking place, and Merkel didn't want to, you know, risk bailing out Greece at the time that she had a campaign going on, or in the coming years that there were harshest rules and tougher decisions were taken for Greeks at the time that there were Dutch or Finnish elections. For example, the True Finns, an extreme right party in Finland, was rallying against another bailout for Greece. So there were successive Greek governments did not understand that, you know, that the decisions and what happens in Greece has repercussions to other member states, and that's why, you know, decisions are taken in such a way. The other finding we had is that many times there was an exchange, for example, that in order to reach something, you would have to get something. In the case of Greece, and we realized that in our reporting, Jean-Claude Juncker had proposed at the very beginning when Tsipras came into power that in order to help you out, if you want some goodwill from our side, you have to solve the Macedonian issue and the Northern Macedonian issue, which was a dispute that had taken ages to be solved. And actually, this happened, and he and Tsipras got some favorable approach. He was given some leniency. And this actually continues right at this moment as well. Only a few weeks ago, the French President Emmanuel Macron blocked the accession of North Macedonia and Albania for domestic political reasons. So you see that theme happening over and over again. Another thing that we found is that a few key people in key positions can make all the difference, and personal chemistry and trust are of paramount importance. In the end of the day, we were surprised to find out that in such a structure, machinery such as the EU, it was largely human nature manifested through emotions, chemistry, and crucially, the clashing personal political interests of the key protagonists, which actually shaped the fate of millions of people. And this is something that this emotional intelligence was something that really the Americans got. Although they were at the other side of the Atlantic, they played a very constructive role and knew how they should talk to each of the protagonists. For example, to Tsipras, they were trying to be like his friendly mentor. To Merkel, when Obama would call her, would appeal to her legacy and stuff. So, and that was also the fact that the Yanis Varoufakis, after a few meetings, he had become toxic. His counterparts were feeling that he was patronizing, he was questioning their intelligence and skills, and he was not offering any proposals that could break the stalemate. And instead, he would go into long speeches on how the world worked, sticking to the theoretical, refusing to engage with the creditor institutions. And some officials were describing his positions as if we were all playing basketball on one court and we had Yanis Varoufakis playing soccer on the court next door. So there was no really communication taking place. And the last point, that while the EU is designed to operate within a very strict framework of hierarchy and protocol, thousands of transactions were taking place. I wanted to add a point also in the migration crisis, when this was a huge domestic problem for the Germans, for Angela Merkel, but also for other EU member states. And Tsipras, from irresponsible leader, turned in few months a reliable partner interlocutor and offered a temporary solution to the problem. And it was clear that once he had become useful to the internal politics of others, not only compromise could be found, but also loosening of implementation of agreed reforms to the detriment of the Greek economy. So although on the surface this story could be about, somebody could think that this is a financial crisis, it's about numbers, it's about deficits and debts, it's much more than that. It's a story of real people. It's charismatic people, yet plagued by vanity, a story of mistakes, miscalculations, gambles who have gone bad, a story where personal interests, ambition, and the chemistry between the protagonists played as important a role as numbers in determining the lives of millions of people.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
So, Hugo, would you like to start us off with some comments?
Yes, thank you so much, and thank you, Victoria and Eleni, for a great presentation to an excellent book. It's really reads like a fly on the wall in so many meetings in so many capitals around the world, not just Europe, as they've said. So it's really great journalism. And my locus standi is that I also was, as a journalist, writing about this crisis, mainly as a commentator, often for the New York Times and Reuters, and I was going not so much to Brussels, actually, but mainly to Athens and a little bit to Frankfurt and to some of those southern capitals that you were talking about. I was going quite a lot to Italy and Spain in those days. So it seems to me, I'm going to structure my remarks around four sort of groups of, or protagonists and groups of protagonists, really. First, Tsipras, the prime minister. Second, Varoufakis, the finance minister. Third, the creditors. And then I'm going to end tiny bit with the current prime minister, Mitsotakis. And I'm going to ask some questions, and then I'm going to give some of my own answers to these questions, but I'm going to leave some of them open. So, Tsipras, could he have done better if he had presented an agenda at the start when he became prime minister of attacking right-wing vested interests? And I always thought, it's when I spoke to him when he was the leader of the opposition, I said, look, you're going to piss off a lot of people, but one thing that you could do that people would understand is if you attacked the vested interests of the right, the oligarchs. Now, there was a lot of talk about that, but no action. So I think that was a big missed opportunity. But, of course, the problem was that he himself was compromised by those vested interests of the right. He really wasn't as free from them as he pretended. Secondly, how bad was it that he seemed so completely naive when it came to international relations? I mean, one of the things that you mentioned in your book was there was a key moment where he denounced a proposal that the creditors had made to him as absurd. He sort of basically seemed to be suggesting to the EU that he was going to go along with it, and then he went back to the Greek parliament and said, it is absurd. And then I think it was Juncker who complained to him, yes. And he said, but I said it in Greek. I mean, maybe he really didn't believe that they couldn't follow what was going on in Greece, but actually, you sometimes find this here in the Brexit crisis, that people say things to the Daily Mail or the Sun, somehow thinking that in Brussels they can't read English. So then, another question about Tsipras is when he called this referendum, what did he actually think was going to happen? And what did he think would happen if he won it? Because what happened is he won it, and then he immediately did a somersault, a colotumba. Did he actually think that he would get that ohi, that no vote to the package, and the creditors would suddenly say, oh, Mr. Tsipras, of course we're going to give you what you want? Did he really think that? Did he not realize that there would be capital controls and that the banks would be rationing how much cash you could get out of the ATMs? Was he completely just ignorant about what was about to hit him? Or, I mean, that's one interpretation, I suppose. Another interpretation, perhaps, is that he knew it was going to happen, but at that moment, he really didn't have any other political alternative. And then linked to that question is, as we know, the celebration turns to despair within minutes or hours or whatever of the result, and by the next morning the president has called him and the other leaders of the party into an emergency meeting, and they agree, Tsipras agrees, supported by them, to go back into discussions with the EU and the other creditors, and then within about a week or so they've done another deal which is even more austerity than the deal that he'd rejected. So that change happened within hours. Now, my question is, when did Tsipras know he was going to make the colotumba? Did he only decide to do it after the result came in? Or did he already know, hours before, days before, maybe even weeks before, that he was going to make that colotumba? So those are my questions about Tsipras. Varoufakis. So, Varoufakis, I met for the first time the day before the election in January 2015, and I went to his house by the Acropolis, which is famous for the feature that a couple of months later, in the midst of austerity, this lovely flat with him and his wife in front of the, appeared in Paris Match. Anyway, I was astonished by his ignorance about two very important things. One was how the IMF operated, and the other was how the European Central Bank operated. Now, these were two very important institutions that he was going to have to deal with as finance minister. So the question I have is about that is, when did Tsipras know that his finance minister was ignorant? Because clearly, at the beginning, Tsipras was ignorant, but at some point he realized, and he thought, my God, this amazing Varoufakis, he knows everything, and he's, you know, knows how to deal with international guys, and he's got this fantastic game theory, et cetera, et cetera. But at some point, he realized that he'd let him down. When did that happen? And not just let him down, but actually was ignorant. Second question, which is linked to that, is how did he completely misunderstand the contagion risk? So back in 2012, there was a serious risk of contagion. That's when Greece almost went bust before. And that's when Draghi came out, and he said he would do whatever it takes within the remit of the European Central Bank to basically stop the crisis spreading. And that moment, you had Portugal, Ireland, but really importantly, Spain was sort of on the brink. It was called the Spanish Panic, or the SPANIC, some people called it. But by 2015, a lot had changed. And you talk about how a lot had changed. But this is not just being wise after the event. People already knew that a lot had changed. Mm. And so how did the people in Athens, the key decision makers, including Varoufakis, not realize that? And then the third question is what you don't really give a clear answer to. Because within hours of the referendum result, Varoufakis had resigned. Did he jump, or was he pushed? Now, coming on to the creditors. In my view, Eleni, when you spoke about the mistakes of the creditors, and broadly speaking, that's under the sort of rubric of were the creditors too nasty, were they beastly to Greece, or indeed within hours after the Kolotumba, there was this hashtag that went viral: "This is a coup." Essentially, so were the institutions sort of beastly, unnecessarily beastly? Now, I think that there was or incompetent, or they got it wrong, and the creditors. Now, it seems to me that there were lots of things that they did wrong. But of course, it depends how far back you go. But in my view, the most important thing was at the start of the crisis, not agreeing to a write down of the debt. At the start of the crisis, and this is really key, at the start of the crisis, the debt was not owed to countries. It was owed to the private sector. And if there had been a debt write down then, the political issues that Eleni talked about wouldn't have been there, or at least they wouldn't have been there in the same form. I mean, they would have been there because some of the people who would have been hit would have been French and German banks, and then their governments would have had to recapitalize it. And then it would have been seen not just that the guilty Greeks for borrowing too much, but the silly banks for lending too much. Anyway, that seemed to me was a really key error, not doing that. Secondly, was an you go into this a bit in your book, in the sort of the previous government was Samaras, and it actually was doing quite well until the European elections of 2014, at which point Samaras got a fright because Tsipras did well, and then Samaras, shifted from being a sort of good boy into trying to play the populist, but of course he couldn't compete out populist Tsipras. So the question for me is really, was there at that sort of point just before the European elections, was there an opportunity? There could have been some promise that could have been made about debt relief, probably conditional debt relief, mm-hmm. and was an opportunity missed by a lack of imagination by the creditors at that moment in time. And then I want to say, you talk a bit about it. I'm not going to go into Paul Thompson. There's a lot of fascinating stuff about individuals in this, but you say that they were shocked that day when you decided to write this book. They were shocked that there was this referendum. I mean, my question is, why were the creditors shocked? The idea that there was going to be a referendum wasn't something that came out of the blue. Varoufakis had been mentioning it at least in March. I just looked up a tweet that I did in March of that year about Varoufakis talking about a referendum. So this was more than 3 months beforehand. Why were the creditors not prepared for that? And then the Germans. At the end of this sort of, after the crisis, there was then the sort of moment, could they do a deal or they couldn't they do a deal? And the hard man was Schäuble, Wolfgang Schäuble, the finance minister. And he came up with this this really hardline scheme, which was basically kick Greece out of the euro for 5 years, sort of time out, and put 50 billion euros worth of assets, which in Greece there weren't 50 billion euros of assets to be had, but put them into a Luxembourg company that he happened to chair. And was he really being serious? Was that really serious? Or was that just an attempt to sort of a part of a sort of negotiating ploy? You ask for something completely ridiculous and hope to get something sort of in the middle that you're happy with. It seemed to me that that was, when I look at the mistakes that the creditors made, particularly the European creditors, you've got to look at this not just in the context of Greece. You've got to look at what it did to the whole of Europe. And one of the things that it did was it actually made Brexit easier, because the narrative that the Europeans, particularly the Germans, were beastly to the Greeks, played, curiously enough, it played both to the left here and to the right. The left said, oh my God, the EU is just all about austerity. We can't have that because we don't want austerity. And the right, people like Norman Lamont, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer here, teamed up with Varoufakis. I mean, quite a bizarre sort of Tweedledum and Tweedledee. And it was, oh my God, it just shows how bad the euro is, which just shows how bad the EU is. So you had this, and I think this was partly because, although in my view they didn't behave it too badly, but I think that there was some beastliness and that actually undercut things. Okay, I'm not going to talk about Mitsotakis. Enough's enough.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Hugo. That was an excellent set of challenges and contextual points. I think I'm going to limit myself just to one more general comment, and that is that, of course, for the 2015 case, so much was... it's difficult to look at the entire audience here. For the 2015 case has so often been described as a game of chicken and who would blink first. And the parallels are drawn, as Hugo suggested, with Brexit. Can I just make one general comment? A game of chicken assumes that the players are following rational interests, which are consistent
which are clearly understood by different sides. And the classic game of chicken is two drivers in two separate cars going to a cliff and waiting to see whether the other driver will blink first and adjusting accordingly. It strikes me that this is not a game of chicken. Indeed, in the Adults in the Room book, Varoufakis himself says, quote, it was never a game of chicken. He makes the argument that we should have been prepared to follow through. If the deal was not acceptable, we should indeed have followed through with an alternative. But it strikes me that it's not a game of chicken for a number of reasons. Did the various players, and Hugo's outlined them expertly, did the various players share the same conception of what the game was actually about, and indeed able to identify the other players in the game? That is that this is a game, if it is such, which goes beyond a kind of rational interest understanding to take account of personalities, psychologies, we've had the references to egos and vanities, etc. But we also have a set of perceptions which are based on very divergent political philosophies, ideologies, different world views, as it were, and a misperception of the other players. Hugo's mentioned already the misinterpretation of the German response, the European misperception of what Syriza might be about in 2015 in terms of the negotiation. So a set of misjudgments, but also in the sense of a set of tactics which seem to contradict the strategy. If this was really a game of chicken, if it was really the last bluff, as it were, then we have tactics which seem to be self-contradictory. Varoufakis goes around Europe insulting, provoking people, losing friends, going to ECFIN meetings that you describe as, quote, catastrophic, etc. If he really is the arch game theorist, who is has a clarity of strategy, then this is someone who is self-contradictory between strategy and tactics. And of course, it's not only on the Greek domestic front, but also on the EU side as well, that this is a book which rightly identifies the contradictory, confusing signals being given to Athens from the EU itself, the EU of the 28, the European Central Bank, the Kanzleramt in Berlin, etc. So it's not as if we simply have two wonderfully clear, rational actors pursuing a game of chicken, waiting to see whether it's a bluff or whether it's who will blink first, but rather a game. In game theory, there is an alternative formulation, which is called a hyper game. It's a model in which there are misperceptions. People don't recognize the game that they're playing. They don't recognize the number of players involved. And their interests, their strategic interests, derive from different sets of ideas, different conceptions, different worldviews. So when I was reading the book, and like Hugo, I definitely think the book is a wonderful example of high-quality journalism. It's an excellent account of the 2015 case, written in a very fair and informative, authoritative fashion. But perhaps when I was reading it, it was just this sense that our international simplification of the crisis as being a game of chicken and waiting to see who would blink first is actually precisely that, a simplification. It's not adequate. It doesn't answer Hugo's point as to what the finance minister and the prime minister thought they were doing and why Tsipras eventually ditched his finance minister, why he retreated from the strategy. So, not a simple game of chicken, but a game of multiple games, hyper game, contending perceptions, misunderstandings, indeed, almost, dare I say, a Shakespearean tragedy of high proportions. Can we invite the two of you to make some quick responses, and then I want to open up to the audience. Don't feel obliged to respond to everything, just your headlines.
Sure, we have about 7 pages of notes on Hugo's questions, so we may not touch upon everything. First of all, sorry, I forgot to thank you guys earlier when I started, so thank you very much, Kevin, for having us here, and thank you very much, Hugo, for being here. Hugo's actually my first real boss, so it's a bit full circle having him here today, but anyway. But he's very unbiased about the book. I'm just going to touch upon a few of the points made, sorry, and then I think you just come in whenever you want to. A lot of the questions that you asked us, you should probably ask the people themselves. There's a few things that only Tsipras can know, only Varoufakis can know, but attempting to answer a few of them, how bad was it that he seemed so naive? I think that was kind of at the core of the problem that they had. I think there was a small room for maneuver, a slight willingness from the EU side of the creditors to give Greece some flexibility and to give this new government some flexibility. And the fact that the incoming government was so, ignorant about EU procedures and the way the EU works really, I think, pushed everything back in terms of progress. And I think that was quite detrimental to what happened during that time. When Tsipras knew that he would make the turn, again, that's one for him, that's a big mystery for a lot of people. What we found in our reporting was that he never, at least during that time or just before he came to government, he never really wanted to leave the euro. That wasn't an option in either his mind or that of his core circle. Of course, Syriza was a coalition of many different small factions, so there were people who wanted to leave the euro, but that was certainly not him. And for him, calling the referendum was much more about managing to get past his party, which was basically the problem he had at home to bring this kind of deal to. So it was more about being able to bring a deal to Parliament that could get through past his party. So I guess in a way like Brexit, the referendum was much more about party politics and it was about the country's future. So that's another...
Let me add a point to that we met one of his closest advisors early on in beginning of February, and we're like, what is he going to do? Is he going to reach a compromise or not? He's like, he's going to reach things to the extremes, to the limit, to the limit that for you guys might be after the limit. And we're like, okay, and what about the economy? What about the banks? And he's like, oh, the banks, like, it wasn't really something that really bothered them at that time. It was more about going through the deal, keeping the party together, reaching the things to the outer limits, and the banks was a collateral damage.
And then maybe a bit on Varoufakis. When did Tsipras know that basically, he was kind of out. I think for us, that was April that we really, I think that's when the realization came after this Eurogroup in Riga, which was, it went very bad. But I think what was more important about it was that Tsipras kind of realized that the information he was getting from his finance minister wasn't really reflecting what was happening on the creditor side. And from April onwards, he was practically sidelined throughout until the end, until the day he resigned or was pushed out again. That's probably something you should ask the two of them.
And also from the very beginning, the other members, Dijsselbloem, the head of the Eurogroup, realized even from the first Eurogroup that I have to talk to Tsipras, and there was a channel of communication between the two of them. So from the very beginning, the Europeans knew that if they wanted to reach a deal, they had to talk to Tsipras himself and not to Varoufakis.
And just very briefly on the creditors, and I think Eleni will talk a bit more about the debt issue with Samaras, I think why they were shocked. The idea of a referendum was there all along. I think what was shocking about it at that point was that it was the timing of it. It was 3 days before the bailout was going to expire, the announcement of it. It was 3 days before the country had to repay the IMF. It was basically a guaranteed default and an exit of a bailout without any kind of follow-up agreement. So I think the timing of it was surprising, but more than the substance of it, but also the question that it posed and the fact that the government kind of openly backed the no vote. I think that was a surprising element.
And also the creditors, the day before, they thought, when we talked to them, they thought they were really close to a deal. So when he called her, and they were actually negotiating till that night, his team was there in Brussels negotiating, so they could not believe that, you know, we are so far apart to call a referendum. I mean, the impression that they had was that we are actually reaching towards a compromise. So maybe that says something about the creditors, that they really didn't understand where the Greeks were standing. On your question about Samaras and was there an opportunity before the EU elections on debt relief, I think the Europeans miscalculated the consequences of not starting a debate on the debt relief. In 2014, before the EU elections, you're right, Greece had just exited the markets after 5 years. The numbers were showing that there would be growth in next year. But the debt relief was not brought again because of politics. It was Merkel had insinuated to Samaras at that point that let's not talk about it now because I have elections to go through. And also the Europeans were saying that, okay, you've reached primary surplus, which was one of the major, one of the things that the government had to do in order to get debt relief, but they also had to complete the program, which Samaras hadn't done. But of course they could have started some kind of discussion. They didn't need to give the debt relief. They could have given him some leeway. But that's in retrospect. They didn't know what would follow the next months.
Okay, can we go to the audience? I think there are both upstairs and downstairs, there are colleagues with a microphone. Could you please simply indicate who you are and then go to your question? I should have mentioned at the very beginning, the entire evening is being recorded, so that's why we must wait for the microphones. So who'd like to begin with a question or comment, please? Can we take the lady here, please? I'm standing up because we can't see people here.
Hello, my name is Sophie Frew. I had a question for you guys about when you were writing the book. How did it change your perception of the events that you'd obviously lived through, and then going back over it, what was the big thing that changed for you?
Thank you. Personally. Other comments or other questions? Could we take the gentleman here, please? We'll take a small group of questions.
Thank you, Dimitri Mournoudis. Excellent book. I've read it in Greek. I haven't read the English version yet. Looking 4 years later, do you think both sides have learnt how to play the game better? We have a new government which is claiming that they will negotiate somehow to reduce the 3.5% budget surplus. Do you think it's again just talking to local politics, or things will possibly be more efficient this time? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. And the question here, please, the gentleman in the white shirt.
Hi, my name is Panos Papoutsis. As you said, back then we weren't sleeping for days or months, and it was a very tough period. But the hard truth is that the majority of Greeks didn't have a clue what was going on, what were the risks. And I want to ask you, because I talked to a lot of Greeks of various ages up to now, and I still feel they don't have a clue what were the high risks back then. Do you feel that with this book and with the information that is shared now, this is changing in the Greek society or not? Thank you very much.
Thank you. That was a question right over here, the gentleman in the blue. We'll come back for one last round of questions.
Hi. I haven't read your book. My name's Jane. I happen to be half Greek, but I don't speak Greek, unfortunately. I wondered if you could say something about the Greek civil service, if it exists, you know, because you rather hope that naive politicians are going to be helped by an administrations and officials. I mean, does that exist in Greece or not?
Okay. As we know in the case of Brexit, for example,
absolutely.
Whitehall is certainly... Anyway, would you like to respond to these
Sure.
points?
Okay, I'll start with a couple. The first question, our perception changed a bit as we were writing it. I think it goes to the point we said earlier about it's all much more nuanced and much more complicated than it seems at the heat of the moment when events are unfolding. I think at that time everything is a bit more black and white to everyone, but as you look back, you understand a lot better the motivations of people. And you also, I think for us, because we started to look at, as I said, like all the different centers of power, I think you start seeing a lot more about what's happening behind the scenes, which may be affecting decisions in a way that you didn't know at the time. So I guess it changed a bit as we were writing it, and maybe... Yeah, of course, yeah, that's true, actually. And the much more important role of the personalities in these events that we anticipated in kind of institution like the EU, it's actually much more about chemistry in a lot of situations, which is a bit, it's interesting, but also a bit scary, possibly. Maybe I'll say about the risks and Greeks having no clue. I think it's probably not fair to say this about people. I mean, they were in a crisis for many years. I think confusion is very natural, or just, you know, intense sentiments in general. What we did with this book, I think we have the plan Bs of what would happen in terms of a Grexit. So we outlined these in the books, and they, you know, they're the closest we could get to explaining what would happen, what the risks were, what was at stake. So in that sense, we do hope that anyone who reads it can see kind of that side of the risks involved.
And on your question on 4 years later, if the sides are more educated, I mean, the Greeks have tried all possible combinations. They started with a center-left government, center-right government, extreme-left government, and they've tried them all, and they've realized that if you want to stay in the euro, you have to do the hard reforms. And I think this government, which is second round coming back, is very cautious. And what we've seen till now is that really wants to keep the creditors in the loop and doesn't want to surprise everyone and wants to do things step by step. So that's a positive thing. It means that they have learned from the mistakes of the past. So let's hope they will continue in that way. And on your question on the civil service, I mean, this is a very big problem, a structural problem in Greece. And unfortunately, after so many years of program reforms, this has not been fixed in a way that we don't have a civil service that is structured and can work without the leadership. What happens in Greece is that when a new government comes in, people in the key posts change and there's no continuity. So it's really hard to continue with reforms, and there's not a memory of the system. So, and unfortunately, this did not really change after all these reforms.
Okay. Can I just
at the end, okay. Hugo? There are lots of people. The guy in the blue.
Hi. Thank you. My question follows the first question from the gentleman over there. We've talked about a lot about the actors, the players of the game, and human agency. And the counterfactual is basically to say that if they learn from their mistakes, or had they been better prepared, things could have been different. But my question is, how much is actually human agency, and how much is actually the rules of the game? How much is it about the institutions, the system that is put in place, and whether, I don't know, changing the actors would actually change the outcome of the negotiation? Thank you.
Good, thank you. Manuel is here, please.
Thank you. Manolis Galinianos, I'm a professor of economics at the University of London. So I have the following question about Tsipras. So after the referendum, he did a complete U-turn, which was immensely costly for him politically, not immediately, but eventually. And so I was wondering if he indeed, as you suggest, always intended to do that. Why did he not do that earlier? Perhaps he did not intend to do that and he figured out that there was no way around. Or was it a personal constraint? He didn't know what the options were. Was it, how big were these party constraints that you suggest? And how were these constraints alleviated by winning that referendum? That's not very clear to me.
Okay.
Thank you.
And the lady in blue.
It seems that in both cases, Greece, including Brexit, it seems that the players overestimate their own hands and underestimate their opponents in negotiation, which is a huge issue in all negotiations. So Greeks thought that if they leave, then the rest of Southern Europe would leave, therefore they wouldn't agree, give something. And Britain is thinking the same way, that at the end of the day, they would never let Britain to leave because of the size of the economy and so on. And it seems in both cases they actually failed to appreciate the dynamics of both their own hands as well as the euro. The question is, would you think that because of these two crises, actually euro became more cohesive and stronger in holding on to its beliefs and even institutions rather than collapsing as Britain definitely thought that it was going to collapse very soon.
Okay, thank you. We're short of time. I wonder if I could invite Hugo to make any final comments before coming to the authors.
Okay, just as far as the future is concerned and where we are now, my view is that I do think that Greece's problems are very deep, and it's not just these twin deficits that they had of, you know, a current account deficit and a budget deficit. The problem is to do with the culture. Now, that's not the DNA, that's not something in the genes of the Greek people, but there is a lot of corruption in the system. There is a lot of interference in the judiciary by the government, interference in what should be independent institutions like the tax authority or the statistics or whatever else it might be. And in my view, the creditors, they focused too much on fiscal matters and not enough on the structural, cultural matters. And I think part of the problem also is that the successive Greek governments haven't taken adequate ownership, adequate responsibility for the problems. And so there was, again, endless rejection of these solutions which seemed to be imposed on them from the outside. And I don't really know, but I do think Mitsotakis is clearly a significant improvement from Tsipras. But I still think the jury is out whether the current, it's not just one person, it has to be the whole society, has to take responsibility for what has happened, has to understand what has happened, and has to be prepared to take the necessary actions. And I don't know. Better than it was, but anyway.
Must try harder.
I want to make a point on what you said. An EU official told us, and I think it's very, very successful the way he described it, that when a country has a fiscal problem, has a twin deficit and everything, this is the top of the iceberg. It means that underneath there are underlying problems of decades, structural problems. And what the institutions tried to do and all these reforms that took place for so many years, they dealt only with the fiscal problems, which were only the top of the iceberg. The problems are very, very deep and structural in our country, which we hope that in the coming years can be somehow improved.
No, that's it. I actually wanted to make the iceberg point. No, but it's fine. No, you're right. I mean, it's ownership. It's the opposite. Like, if you fix fiscal problems, that's very easy to blame to someone else on the outside that it's imposed austerity. But structural requires a degree of ownership that's always been quite hard to find in Greece with all the governments so far. So let's see what happens. Maybe just very quickly on the questions, or your question on agency versus the rules of the game. I think obviously the rules of the game are what sets the framework for these kinds of negotiations and crises, but I think personalities and human agency can either facilitate and enable a situation or torpedo it. So they're kind of like important on the more marginal end, but quite important. And then maybe on Europe after these two crises, Brexit and Grexit, and whether, I think it's too soon to say whether it's become more unified. Certainly with Brexit, there's a lot more of a united, like a very united front. But again, there are different types of crisis. Again, as we were saying, you know, we've been saying Brexit is like negotiating the terms of a divorce. Grexit was kind of trying to hold a marriage together. So there are different types of crises. And I think, at least to me, because the EU is going through kind of a weird existential potentially phase right now, it's hard to tell yet whether it's brought the union closer together, and that I think is also affected largely by what's happening outside of Europe too, which is also in a pretty strange time with Trump in the US. So I think it's too soon to tell, at least on that part. I don't know If you want to add anything
on your questions on why didn't he do the U-turn earlier on, I think it's completely party politics. I mean, he had to show, don't forget that 30% of his party at that time was for exiting the euro, so they were very extreme, and it's a large amount of his party. And I think he really needed to show that I've done my best. You know, I've reached my limits. I've brought a deal with sweat, blood, and tears. I've gone through a referendum. This is the best I could do. You know, and what you realize looking back, it was not ideological for him, because from the moment he signed the deal, He did all the reforms without even blinking, so it means that it wasn't really ideological. It was just keeping the party together and maintaining the power.
Thank you. The point about bargaining, etc., generations of students in the social sciences have studied key episodes of international negotiation. We think in political science of an entire literature, for example, on the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the notion that that was a game of chicken. It strikes me that what we have with the various cases, references been made to Grexit, references to Brexit, but you might also add the Italian contest in terms of Matteo Salvini and the deficit budget of Italy, or Poland and the resistance against Brussels in terms of judicial reforms. Strikes me that these are four cases of a different type from the past. These are cases of relative weakness vis-a-vis EU27. But in all four cases, there's a populist determination to raise the campaign, to pursue the campaign on behalf of some kind of national interest. Sometimes we talk about the weapons of the weak or strength from weakness, when you're in a position of weakness vis-a-vis the opponent. But these are cases, Greece, Salvini in Italy, and I would suggest many of the aspects of Brexit as well, where the weak actually conclude with concessions. That is, they give ground to the other side. So it's not a question of using the weapons of the weak. Rather, it's a concern about, my God, we may bring the system down, and bringing the system down is not in our own national interest. So institutions, agency. On the institutional points, let me suggest that across these cases, I think where the misperception has come, or the misunderstanding has come, is about the nature of the European Union, something brought out very well in the book. As the European Union being a very rules-based system with strongly embedded institutions, a machine that responds to a particular stimulus in the same way across all four different types of cases, and a misunderstanding on the part of the opponent that that is how the European Union would indeed respond. So I think it's a case in Greece of 2015, where social scientists will indeed come back to these aspects, come back to study it as a system, as a case of negotiation, a episode of bargaining, think about how game theory fits it, etc. So I think future students and scholars will look at the Greek case in 2015 as a case which may tell us something about rationality in bargaining in terms of institutional settings, the relevance of human agency. And when future students and scholars do look at this case of bargaining, I think the book that has been presented this evening will be an excellent basis for understanding the nature of the case. So can you please join me in thanking our presenters? I must also thank the excellent discussant, Hugo Dixon, for his comments, and to remind, please. and to remind you that after this we can continue the discussion in the wine reception, which is on the fifth floor of the old building in Houghton Street. It is in the senior common room. Can we pursue the discussion there? Thank you.